Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 11, Spearhead from Space. On this podcast, Martin is safely back on the other end of a Skype line, which is probably best for us both.
I totally agree.
Yes, how are you, Martin? All right?
I'm very well, thank you. And yourself?
Not bad, thank you. Not bad. Before we crack on into the headlong rush that is Spearhead from Space, a little bit of feedback left over from the Five Doctors podcast. This time it's from my brother, Rob. He says, I agree with most of your and Martin's comments. The best science fiction relies on you suspending your disbelief on one impossible fact, but everything else being logically correct if that impossible fact was true. The multi-doctor stories require too many impossible things to be believed to work well as proper science fiction. I quite enjoyed watching it as a pure adventure story, ignoring the scientific explanations given by the various doctors. The story is well crafted enough to give each generation of fan a good view of their doctor. I even think we saw the right amount of Tom Baker. A little aside here is Rob's doctor is John Pertwee, mine is Tom Baker, so there's a sibling rivalry there. He goes on to say, you're right about the direction of production, though. It did seem poor, even by 80s standards. Fixing this would have improved the overall impact of the show and made the logical impossibilities easier to swallow. Modern Hollywood films are so watchable because the effects and direction compensate for the generally mediocre plots. He then adds, I'm looking forward to your OCD deconstruction of Spearhead from Space. So thanks very much for that, Rob. We'll hear a little bit more from Rob at the end when he gives a slightly less OCD deconstruction of Spearhead from Space. But on to ours. Yeah, I chose this one, so I'll give a little bit of context for the story. As I'm sure many or all of you will know, this is John Pertwee's first story. It was filmed in 1969 and broadcast in January 1970. It kicks off the Third Doctor's Earth Exile strand, which lasts for most of his incarnation. There's a number of firsts in this, obviously the first John Pertwee story. It's the first time the show was broadcast in colour. And there's a few other things that we'll come across when we go through the story. It's written by Robert Holmes. It's his third story after writing The Crotons and the Space Pirates, none of which pulled up any trees, as they say. But I think he hits the ground on his third one very well. His working title is Facsimile.
A better title, I think.
Yeah, it is. It's a good title. They didn't tend to have one-word titles, though, did they, in those days?
No, I can't remember any. But
he would have stood out a little bit, I suppose, but it's a great title. The director is Derek Martinus. And the producer is Derek Sherwin, who also features in the story, which we'll mention a little bit later. Mm. The script editor was the mighty Terence Dix. So that's the context for it. And of course, we start with a new title sequence. It's still the howl around sort of visual feedback approach they used for the previous two Doctors, but of course this time it's in colour.
Mm.
And you get some kind of strange sort of target in the background, don't you? It's sort of like a coloured target behind all the howl around effects, and various colours move through the sequence, don't they?
I thought the music, the title music, seemed a bit all over the place, actually. It didn't seem as if it was running in the right order in some places.
Yeah, you're right. Particularly on the exit music at the end of the episodes, they overlay it. One part of it as another bit's kind of fading out, don't they? It sounds quite disjointed.
Yeah. So it opens with a shot of Earth in space. It's a photograph. I think it was taken from one of the space missions, wasn't it?
Yeah, Apollo 8.
Yeah. And overlaid, you hear the sound, it's kind of ringing sound, which we later will recognise what it is as the sound of the Nestines. You get some stock footage of a radar tower, and then inside, there's a sweaty man who's watching something on the radar.
Which is sort of a template, isn't it, for a lot of the beginnings of stories from this era, aren't they? His unit spotting something heading towards Earth.
And he calls to his superior, who comes in, and it's a woman. He sort of says that he's found something on the radar that looked like meteorites.
Quite a big thing, I think, that his superior is a woman in 1970. That would probably seem quite advanced to the 1970s viewer. Mm. And the other interesting thing is that they're wearing the same unit uniforms as they had in the invasion, aren't they?
except they're in colour.
Except they're in colour, yes. Yes, rather than a sort of grey, they're now sort of beige, aren't they?
That's right.
But of course, that later on, as Pertwee's era progresses, they turn into more sort of khaki, sort of regular army type of stuff, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, the woman mentions that there's a heat wave, which probably accounts for the sweatiness of the man. And he sort of says that these meteorites appear to be flying in formation, and they're heading straight towards them. The next thing we see is a poacher in some woods nearby.
Well, there's a little scene in the sky, isn't it, of these objects flying in formation, but it clearly looks like the Red Arrows or something, doesn't it?
It's yeah.
Clearly some aeroplanes in formation.
And you also get a close-up shot of them. Only for a second, which is probably just as well, because they don't look particularly good.
Oh, it's a photograph with some sort of smoke blown across it, isn't it?
Yeah. And he kind of dives for cover as they sort of hit the ground, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right, and there's a kind of explosion as you see one of them land, doesn't it? This place is the fictional Oxley Woods, but it's actually the Royal Horticultural Gardens at Wisley, which I've actually been to, but at the time I didn't realise that that's where Spear from Space was shot.
Just as well, otherwise he probably wouldn't have gone. He'd have been too scared.
Yeah, either that or I'd have gone wearing a frilly shirt and a velvet smoking jacket. That probably wouldn't have been allowed in.
No, I wouldn't let you in. It cuts back to the radar station, and they say that these things seem to have landed somewhere in Sector 5, which is Epping, apparently.
Actually, that blows my theory out, doesn't it, where it's always Sector 7.
Aha, yes. Yeah. I knew you were talking rubbish.
not for the first time. Well, probably not the last.
This poacher uncovers one of these meteorites, and it's making this kind of ringing noise that we've heard earlier, and it's pulsating, sort of flashing, sort of a pink glow to it, isn't it? Mm. And he sort of reaches out towards it, but it's obviously hot, so he pulls his fingers back in, and then he starts to cover it up again. Throughout this scene, his face is just hilarious. He's putting these really aghast or amazed faces, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's quite excited about the whole thing, isn't he? But you see him pushing some earth over it, and you get the impression he's probably going to come back for it later, isn't he? He's hiding it to make sure no one else finds it. Mm. At this point, we find out that control at the radar station has been formed, Unit HQ. And then we get the TARDIS model appearing in a model set, don't we?
It's really weird because there's absolutely no need for it. It looks rubbish, and it's there for about a second, and then it cuts to the real TARDIS in the real woods, and the door opens, and the Doctor falls out face down into the heather, doesn't he?
Yeah, I can only assume they had some sort of issue with the actual materialization effect on location. Maybe it didn't work, and they just had to restage it. Via a model, but they are there in the location with the TARDIS. So, it does seem a bit strange and unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, no, so you only see it for a second. It just kind of, it does spoil it a little.
It does.
But you don't really get a good look at the Doctor, do you? He sort of falls to face down into the heather, as I said, and it cuts immediately to a woman being driven in a car, sort of through London, isn't it? And it's, as we're about to find out, it's Liz Shaw, and she's being taken to the unit headquarters. The car sort of pulls into an underground car park, which is, I think it's filmed around King's Cross. Mm. And the car park attendant, as you mentioned earlier, is Derek Sherwin.
Yeah, he's the producer. Just thought that should say that there's some fab and groovy 70s flute accompaniment, isn't there, to Liz Shaw's drive through London?
Yeah, there is.
Superb. It does sadly rather date the program instantly, but it's nice. It's a good atmosphere.
So we cut to the Brigadier, who's up in his office, and he welcomes Liz in. And she immediately starts complaining about the security measures that she's had to go through. Mm. I suppose we should really talk about the Brigadier here. He's appeared in Doctor Who at this point a couple of times before, hasn't he, in Web of Fear and the Invasion.
Mm.
But it's now, he's going to become a regular for quite a while.
Another thing we ought to mention is the fact that there was an industrial dispute at the BBC at this time, which meant all the scheduled studio sessions were cancelled for this story, which meant that they had to hurriedly shoot things in various locations, and all on film, which gives it quite a unique look, doesn't it?
It's
the only story, certainly in that era, that was all in on film, and all in location. So most of the locations they choose are the BBC's Engineering and Training Centre in Wood Norton, which is near Evesham, and the radar tracking station room is there, and Brigadier's office is there, and various other things that we come across are also shot at Wood Norton. So you make very good use of it, I think.
Yeah,
it doesn't at any point feel like it's all in one place, does it?
No, not at all. No, they've done a really good job of it, I think. So we find out a little bit about Liz. She's been working in Cambridge. She's been brought down to unit almost against her will, really. She's an expert in meteorites. She's got degrees in medicine, physics, and, according to the Brigadier, a dozen other subjects.
Yeah, this is a slight issue, isn't it, I think? She looks sort of late 20s, isn't she?
Yeah.
Sure. How could she have 14 degrees by this stage?
She probably hasn't got dozens of other subjects. A couple more, maybe. But yeah.
Or maybe the short postgraduate thing.
Yeah. Or she might have been a child genius.
Yes. Or maybe a fetal genius.
So the Brigadier is sort of trying to recruit her, but she's very sceptical about it all. And he starts to sort of suggest that they're dealing with kind of alien life forms. And she says, what, little blue men with three heads?
Yeah, this is quite a good relationship that Liz and the Brigadier have. She's, as you say, very sceptical. She firstly thinks that they deal with invisible ink and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then she starts taking a mick when he mentions that, you know, they deal with stuff from outside of the Earth. And throughout the story, she sort of gradually softens and gets used to the idea that they are dealing with alien threats.
Yeah.
But, you know, their relationship is quite fractious at the beginning.
And he tells her about these meteorites that have landed, and he refers to the fact that 6 months ago a smaller shower landed in the same area. She sort of says, well, that's almost impossible. And I think that starts to pique her interest.
Yeah, it does. We then cut to another Wood Norton location, but this time it's masquerading as Ashbridge Cottage Hospital. And Captain Munro of UNIT, played by John Breslin, is there overseeing the stretchering in of an unconscious doctor. He explains to Dr. Henderson, the chap who's going to look after the doctor, that the doctor's found near a police box in the woods. There's a brilliant woman sat in his waiting room, isn't there? It couldn't be more 70. She's got this headscarf and this massive eye dressing. And she just reminds me of one of the characters from Monty Python. You know, I suspect her to have a voice like that. But fortunately, she never speaks.
The Brigadier and Liz are still talking about sort of alien life forms. And Liz is sort of saying, well, why, you know, why now? Why would we be invaded this time, not in the last few hundred years? And the Brigadier says it's because, you know, in the last decade, we've been sending probes deeper and deeper into space so that they're effectively drawing attention to ourselves.
There's an excellent line from the Brigadier when Liz continues to be sceptical about the whole alien threat thing. He just stares at her, doesn't he? He just said, it's not my habit to tell lies, Miss Shaw. Really good.
Yeah.
She actually kind of balks a little bit at that, doesn't she?
Yeah, exactly. He refers to, you know, two previous attempts to invade the Earth and refers to being helped by this mysterious doctor, at which point Munro calls to tell him that they found a man in the woods next to a police box.
Yeah, the timing is impeccable, isn't it?
Yeah, the Brig tells him to put an armed guard on the police box and he says he'll be on his way straight away to join him.
There's a nice line from Captain Munro saying it should be informed the police. They might want the police box back. And of course, the Brigadier says, no, on no account do that. It's a bit of a surprise if they ever got into it.
So back at the hospital, there's a nurse who's putting up an x-ray on the wall for Dr. Henderson to have a look at. He sort of goes to have a look and he says to her, you know, somebody been playing a joke. She's, so what do you mean? So what's that? That's his heart. So what's that then? So it appears to have two hearts. She's not much of a nurse, but didn't notice that when she put it up, but there.
Well, this is quite a key moment in Doctor Who history, isn't it? Because that's the first time it's mentioned that the Doctor has two hearts.
So he goes off to call the X-ray department to have a go at them. And he goes out into a corridor where there's somebody's sort of doing some hoovering. Actually, he gets a call on his bleeper thing, doesn't he?
Hmm.
So he picks up the phone to find out who's paged him. And he clicks his fingers at the cleaner, doesn't he, to get him to stop.
Yeah, typical arrogant doctor style.
Yeah. And then he has a conversation with a Dr. Lomax. Before he can get a word out, this Dr. Lomax turns the tables on him and sort of complains that he's sent him a blood sample that isn't even human.
There's an interesting point about the voice of Dr. Lomax. You never actually see Dr. Lomax, but you just hear him on the other side of his phone call. He's actually played by the same young lad who was looking at the meteorites at the unit radar tracking station.
Ellis
Jones. Yeah.
A sweaty man.
Sweaty man, yeah, with a dizzying array of voices. Yeah, he affects this angry Scottish accent, doesn't he, for Dr. Lomax. But it's a nice reply from Dr. Henderson when he discovers that Lomax thinks his blood is not human. He says, I took the patient myself. I don't know if that makes me a doctor or a vet, but it's still my responsibility to look after the patient.
Yeah. But it's been overheard, this conversation, by this cleaner, who is played by Telford Thomas, the
buck-toothed 1970s professional Welshman.
Who plays every single Welshman in anything throughout the 70s.
He turns up in The Green Death, doesn't he? And he's in Survivors, and I don't know if anyone remembers King of the Castle, but he appears in that as well. It's a weird children's program.
He's playing in Mullins the Porter in this story. And he thinks he might be able to make some money out of this because he thinks there's a story. So he goes to call the press. He goes in sort of the public telephone box in the foyer of the hospital.
I hear you pay for stories.
I knew you were going to do that. Meanwhile, the poacher has gone back to look for his meteorite, and he uncovers it and puts it into a sack that he's taken with him. As he's sort of doing that, he hears some voices, and he sort of goes to have a look what it is, and there's some of the unit soldiers who are searching nearby, obviously looking for these meteorites. So he goes back, picks up the sack. It's really funny, actually. He picks the sack up and swings it over his shoulder. Luckily, there's nothing in it. Because if the meteorite was actually in it, it would have knocked him out. It's supposed to be in it, but, you know, it clearly isn't.
Meanwhile, back at the cottage hospital, the doctor wakes up. We still don't see his face at this point, do we? You just see the back of his head as he's leaning over the side of the bed looking for his shoes. Mm. The nurse runs over and puts him back into his bed. She tells Dr. Henderson that he tried to get out of bed, which Dr. Henderson seems amazingly surprised by for some reason.
It's quite funny when the nurse is sort of putting him back in bed. He goes, "Unhand me, madam." Before he falls back unconscious.
We then see the Brigadier and Liz driving up and arriving at the exterior of the hospital, which they used a disused school in Chiswick for the building. It looks very similar to a building used in Matt Smith's first story, The 11th Hour. So I'm wondering if it is the same one. I haven't been able to find that out on the internet. But anyway, they go into the hospital and find it absolutely teeming with pressmen after details about a man from space in the hospital. So this is clearly the work of Mullins, the hospital porter. we see Munro trying to handle all these pressmen, but it's some very good handheld camera work, which gives a real sort of kind of documentary feel and gives an idea of sort of how manic it all is with these.
Yeah, it feels very crowded, doesn't it?
All these feverish pressmen running around trying to get answers from the Brigadier. Unfortunately, at one point, because this handheld camera is whizzing around all over the place, you actually see the lighting rigs providing lighting for the recording, but only in a very split second. Quite effectively, amongst all this melee, there's a very still, mysterious, well-dressed gentleman, who we later find out is Channing, played by Hugh Burton. But he is, you know, like just this one sort of still moment of stillness in all this hubbub.
Mm. The Brigadier arrives and sort of makes his way through this crowd, and they try to question him, but he sort of fobs them off by telling them it's a training exercise, doesn't he? And he manages to get through. And then he's complaining to Monroe about, you know, where they all come from. And then he tells Monroe to issue the soldiers with live ammo. And Monroe seems really surprised at this. I was surprised that they didn't have live ammo in the first place myself. But anyway, they reach the doctor's room, and they meet with Dr. Henderson, who tells them that the patient's cardiovascular system is like nothing he's ever seen. And the Brigadier seems quite happy about this and thinks, yeah, that sounds like the doctor. So he goes over to him, and he kind of turns him over so he can see his face. And we see his face for the first time as well, don't we? But he's a complete stranger, at which point the doctor kind of comes round and looks at the Brigadier and says, oh, hello, Brigadier. Don't you recognise me? And you get a nice scene where he's kind of, he asks for a mirror, doesn't he? He says he can't have changed that much. He asks for a mirror, and Liz gets one out of her bag. And he has a look at his face in the mirror, and he's not impressed at all to start with, is he? But then he sort of says, oh, I don't know, though. It's quite distinctive, actually.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? He's doing all this kind of little monologue to himself about his face. And, you know, you see the Brigadier's face staring at him.
Yeah.
Absolutely stony, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's superb.
But he's quite tired, and he sort of goes back to sleep again, doesn't he? And the Brigadier's sort of saying, oh, you know, I've never seen him before, don't know who he is. He tells Monroe to bring the doctor to Unit HQ as soon as possible. And presumably that's where he's heading off to himself. And he manages to exit via the back entrance to avoid the press.
But one of the pressmen sees Brigadier leaving. Yeah, he's a bit disappointed he can't get any answers from him. But he has a chat with another one of the pressmen, played by Prentice Hancock, who's another doctor who stalwarts, isn't he?
Yeah.
Appearing all over the place. He then decides to telephone his office, so he goes to the little public telephone that Mullins used in the corner. And Channing's in the booth, and he kind of politely asks him whether he can use the phone. But apparently Channing hasn't even been using the phone. But Channing barges out, and this pressman looks a bit sort of aghast at his older thing.
Yeah. Channing's got very strange eyes, hasn't he? It's really creepy. He's kind of, you know, when he's in that booth, he's just sort of staring into nothingness. He's got these really weird eyes.
Occasionally he widens them, doesn't he? Then?
Yeah.
Oh, that's spooky. The poacher's Sam Seeley, isn't it? I don't think we mentioned his name yet, have we? He's stopped by a unit soldier near the TARDIS, when he's guarding the TARDIS, and he tells him that the woods are restricted. And then he discovers from what Sam is saying that he's a poacher, and he tells him to go away and don't come back to the woods until they're de-restricted. Mm. And then Seeley starts asking the soldier about the Thunderballs, and he gives a hint that he might know where to find one of them. But when questioned, he says he was just asking, and then the soldier tells him to push off, so eventually he does.
Yeah, the doctor's searching for his shoes again. Henderson comes back in and sort of goes over to him and says, ask him how he's feeling, and he just looks at me and goes, shoes. That's a word with the nurse, and he says, well, we might as well give him the shoes if that's what he wants. So he gets the shoes out of the locker next to his bed and gives them to him. And the doctor just sort of grabs them and hugs them to him, doesn't he?
Rolls over.
And Henderson says, I wonder if his brain's damaged.
Yeah, he then decides to take his blood pressure again. So he asks the nurse to go and get the Sphygmomanometer machine to do that. The doctor wakes up. Henderson's got his back to him. The doctor wakes up. He finds a TARDIS key in one of the shoes. Sort of puts it in his mouth and puts the shoes under the pillow, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But at this point, two white-coated, shiny-faced men come in, knock Henderson out, and slap some tape over the doctor's mouth, then stick him in a wheelchair and take him away.
As they're kind of wheeling him out, Henderson starts to recover, and he sort of runs out and kind of raises the alarm. These men are outside trying to wheel him into the ambulance, and Channing is also with them. But as they're putting him in, he manages to wheel the wheelchair away at speed, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Channing ushers these two men into the ambulance, and they kind of set off after him. The soldiers have been alerted, and they start shooting at the ambulance. The doctor's continuing to wheel himself downhill at quite a pace. In the woods by the TARDIS, the two soldiers there have heard these shots, and so they realise something's up, and they start to get a bit agitated, don't they? The soldiers find the overturned wheelchair, lift up a blanket, but there's just pillows underneath. The doctor sort of comes through the trees near the TARDIS, and one of the unit soldiers basically just shoots at him. He clutches his head, falls to the ground, and the other soldier says, "Who told you to fire, you stupid?" And the music starts. But yeah, I think it's a great ending to the episode. It suddenly all kind of bursts into life, doesn't it? The last couple of minutes, it's all go. And
yeah, there's a lot of kind of establishing stuff, you know, the general air of sort of mild creepiness, isn't there? And then it all kicks off, doesn't it, with this kidnap. And yeah, and then mortal danger for the Doctor.
Yeah.
Into episode two, as often happens, the sort of reprise of the end of the episode is reshot slightly, isn't it?
There's some differences, notable ones, especially probably the end of this episode, I think, you know, part two, which we'll talk about when we get there. But there doesn't seem to be any reason to reshoot this. In fact, they kind of cock it up a bit, don't they, really? Because when this episode opens, the Doctor comes through the trees and he's already holding his head.
Yeah, it's, yeah, you wonder whether they didn't stick with the original. But, yeah, the Doctor falls to the ground and he's returned sort of immediately to the hospital. We're back with Dr. Henderson, aren't we? And he reveals that the bullet only burned his scalp. So the usual level of accuracy from unit soldiers, although that's closer than usual. But the Doctor appears to be in a self-induced coma, doesn't he?
Mm.
And... Yeah, the Brigadier wonders if that's possible, but of course Henderson doesn't know what's possible because his physiology is completely different to what he's used to.
Henderson has found the Doctor's key, was the key to the TARDIS that he had in his hand, and he tells the Brigadier about it. Presumably the Brigadier takes it from him. And we find out that the TARDIS is on its way back to the unit headquarters. Meanwhile, Munro has found a piece of one of the meteorites, and it's in a kind of metal box, and he's showing the Brigadier this kind of fragment. He says he'll take it with him to headquarters. They discuss why they wanted to kidnap the Doctor. Yes, he also has a photo of Channing, doesn't he, that he shows him at that point?
Yeah, the Brigadier asks whether they saw any of the attackers, whether they got any photos of the attackers, but he said yes, that the nurses recognised that the person leading the kidnap was Channing, and they recognised him from some of the pictures from, you know, taken during the Meadow impressment.
Mm.
But Munro says he had a look at the other two, and he says there was something very odd about their faces.
Mm. It's quite interesting, actually, how quickly it's cut, this story. You quite often get scenes saying, the Brigadier will say, oh, we better go back there then, and then immediately they're at the next location.
Yeah, that happens a few times, doesn't it? It
happens all the way through, actually. The Brigadier's talking to Henderson, you know, in the room with the Doctor, and then suddenly he's with Munro outside looking at the meteorite. And it gives it a really quick pace, the whole story. It doesn't pause for breath, hardly, does it?
Yeah, it's very, very well edited, I think. It's good stuff. And an interesting thing about, again, how it's shot, when Munro makes a remark about their faces, it's very cleverly done, because you just see these figures kidnapping the Doctor, but there's no close-up on their faces. There's just enough for you to think they look a bit odd, isn't there?
That's right, yeah.
Which is quite nicely done, which kind of saves a little bit of the impact when you see the first killer Auton, isn't it? So
yeah.
They're kind of keeping their powder dry a little bit there, which I think works really well. And just another note on locations, the hospital grounds where the Brigadier and Munro have the chat about the sphere. Again, it's Wood Norton, the grounds of Wood Norton. It's the same location as they used in Tom Baker's first story, Robot.
Okay.
So a little bit of continuity there.
Mm. I mean, the other thing I wanted to raise here was, you know, why were they trying to kidnap the Doctor? It's not clear why they'd kidnap him.
Yeah, it's never made clear, is it?
Unless sort of Channing was kind of convinced by these press people that maybe he did have a piece of meteorite. Or he knew something about it. Maybe that's the only reason I can think that they would want to kidnap him, because there's no other reason for it, is there?
Yeah, you get the feeling it's probably a kind of precautionary thing. There's a big furore about this bloke, and they're talking about aliens, and they're talking about meteorites. I guess I just grabbed hold of him, just so maybe he just didn't give them any more information about what he found, if he found something. You know, it's just to get him out of the picture, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. Cut next to some footage of a plastics factory where dolls are being made, aren't they? There's lots of sort of machinery and...
It reminds me of the... there was a BBC children's TV programme called Play School for very young children. And most episodes they had a look around a factory or had some other kind of film sequence in there. And this reminds me of that. You just see the whole process of these dolls being made, which is quite creepy at the beginning, isn't it? Because you get this strange sort of plastic head straight from the moulds. And it just adds an air of creepiness and, you know, some more plastic faces, and it just fits in really well. Mm. It's actually filmed at the favourite doll factory in London, and in this case it isn't stock footage because you actually see the actors walking through the factory as this process is taking place.
There's a kind of very, very plasticky looking woman leading a man through, isn't she?
Yeah, so another point on the DVD here. When this was broadcast, they had some background music. It was an old Fleetwood Mac number, Oh Well, Part 1, was used as the incidental music. Because of rights issues, it's not on the DVD.
Okay. So this woman leads this man who turns out to be a character called Ransom through the factory. He sort of comments that there's been a lot of changes, so he's obviously been there before. And we find out that he used to work there. And he passes a door with an out-of-bounds sign on it, which used to be his workshop. So he's quite sort of put out about what's going on. As he walks towards this office, Channing appears on the stairs behind him. And is kind of watching him as he goes in.
He also, Ransom fails to chat up this silent, mini-skirted, plastic-faced secretary, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And you're new too, aren't you? This is just utterly blank sentence.
Yeah. Anyway, shown into this office where he meets a man called Hibbert, who's obviously his boss, or his ex-boss, who kind of welcomes him in. And it's clear that he's obviously been working for this plastics factory. But he'd been sent to America to strike a deal for this new doll that he'd been working on. And when he came back, having got all the paperwork signed and sealed, he found a letter on his mat saying he'd been given the push. So he's obviously confronting Hibbert about this.
Yeah, George Hibbert is played by John Woodnutt, who is, or becomes, quite another Doctor Who stalwart. He plays a Draconian Emperor in Frontier in Space. He plays both the Duke of Forgel and Broton the Zygon in Terror of the Zygons. Mm. And he plays Saron and Keeper of Trarkon. It's quite an interesting portrayal, isn't it, throughout this story. He clearly seems to be under some sort of mental control, doesn't he, but seems to be struggling with it somehow. He keeps saying, yeah, we've got a new policy all the time to try and explain, you know, why everything's changed and Ransom's been given the boot. And he also, when asked what's happening inside Ransom's old workshop, he sort of very gravely tells him that Ransom should stay away from the workshop and, you know, basically keep away from the factory. So clearly something Channing-related is going on here.
Mm. And as he's sort of saying this to him, he starts to hold the back of his neck, a la John Pertwee, actually. As Channing appears through the door behind them, Hibbert goes and sits back at his desk. Channing just sort of stands there looking menacing. Mm. Hibbert seems to get control of himself and sort of dismisses Ransom, who reluctantly leaves. As he passes these old workshop, he tries the door, but it's locked. Channing is standing in the doorway watching him.
Yeah, his sort of silent presence is quite effective, isn't it, with those terrible eyes?
Yeah, it's very, very creepy.
Yeah. So back at Unit HQ, Liz is running some tests on the meteorite fragment that Munro had. She reckons it's been manufactured, which of course is interesting for a meteorite, and when asked whether it could have come from space, she says there are traces of heat fusion, so yeah, it could have come through the atmosphere. She's still being a bit offhand with the Brigadier about sort of science fiction. It's the idea with facts, not science fiction ideas. And he says something, you know, there just might be something outside your cosy scientific world of facts sort of thing, isn't it?
Meanwhile, Hibbert and Channing are having a conversation. Hibbert's obviously a bit concerned about Ransom's visit. Channing's trying to calm him down. And then he tells him that two of the energy units are missing and that they will increase their pulsations so they can be found. Hibbert sort of says, you refer to these as if they're living things, to which Channing responds, all energy is a form of life. So clearly here, Hibbert knows what's going on, but Channing's got such a hold over him that he doesn't realise that it's bad.
It's an interesting relationship there. Back with Sam Seeley, we see him back at his cottage, don't we? He's got this old box, he pulls out the shed, and he takes the spear that he found out of it. At this moment, we have quite a chilling scene, don't we, in the woods, where there's a sudden, very quick zoom shot onto a killer Auton, which suddenly jerks to life in the woods.
Mm.
This is the first time we see some Autons are just, plastic creatures controlled by their nesting consciousness, which are just designed to kill. And, they're all in these blue boiler suits with scars around their necks, aren't they? It's a practical point to hide the join between the masks and the actors' necks.
The masks are very much, sort of shop window dummy faces, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very, very sort of crude, aren't they? Just the absolute basic. Yeah, eyes, nose, mouth sort of thing, and quite chilling as a result. And we see it jerking to life as his spear is brought out of the box. At that point, though, Sam's wife Meg comes out into the yard, and Sam shoves the spear into the shed, out the box, and then pushes the box into the shed after it.
Hmm.
She accuses him of stealing, and they have an argument, and she checks the box and finds nothing in it. And,
he tells her to go and get him some grub, woman.
Yeah. And then she says, you needn't be getting out that dirty old box in my house. And then wanders in.
He goes back to the box, doesn't he? And she pops her head out again, out the house again to try and catch him.
In the act.
In the act, sort of thing. And he sort of,
what are you staring at, woman?
Quite funny. But anyway, he eventually puts this energy unit into the trunk and closes it, and puts it into the shed, and the Auton in the woods, stops and kind of looks around. It's obviously, can no longer hear this signal. The TARDIS, meanwhile, has been brought to unit headquarters, to the lab where Liz is working, and the Brigadier has his key and a buzzer sounds, and is told that General Scobie has arrived. And this is General from the regular army. And he comes in asking Brigadier what's going on with these meteorites. Brigadier introduces Liz, and Scobie's kind of like, oh, hello.
So a nice 70s sexist chat.
Yeah, the Brigadier sort of says, oh no, she's not just a pretty face.
Yeah, it's odd this scene, because he says, lucky man Stuart having a pretty face around the place. And she sort of smiles. But she seems to get annoyed when the Brigadier says she's not just a pretty face, she's a skilled scientist or whatever.
Yeah,
but you think she'd be annoyed by Scobie, not by the Brigadier saying she's more than a pretty face?
I don't know, maybe she was up for it.
Maybe the Brigadier's ruined her chances, hasn't
it? Yeah.
Scobie sees a police box and asks what it's doing inside the lab. And Liz tells him it's not a police box, it's a spaceship. And there's this sort of comedy face drop, isn't it, from Scobie?
Yeah. Back at the hospital outside, there's a unit soldier, and he's standing guarding this old car, isn't he, which apparently some bigwig has turned up in it. But Munro arrives, takes him away, sort of saying, Section 3 have found a meteorite, so they will drive off to go and find it. Inside the hospital, the doctor's up and about. He's in his kind of long johns, isn't he, sort of night dress type stuff.
Mm.
And he's kind of wandering along the corridor, and he hears some voices, so he's kind of looking around to find a hiding place. There's a door with a Doctor's Only sign on it, which I think is quite good, actually. It's a nice touch.
It's your gag, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes inside.
Yeah, it's a sort of changing room and shower, wash-up room, isn't it?
He goes in, he sees his shower, and he kind of looks at it, and then he grins to himself. Henderson and this hospital bigwig, they enter the room, and they go through into the shower room, and the Doctor's basically under the shower, wearing nothing other than a hairnet.
And a smile.
And a smile. And he's kind of singing in the club style, isn't he? you know, the Vic Reeves, fun star from Shooting Stars. You know, a kind of an unintelligible song, while Henderson and this other fellow are kind of, I suppose he's taking them in there to freshen up, and he sort of takes his cape off, and he's kind of dressed in very fancy clothes, isn't he, this fella?
Yeah, and they're sort of talking about the patient, actually, aren't they, not knowing that the patient is actually in the room.
Exactly.
It's quite strange that the doctor is, you know, essentially he's got back to him, he's hiding, isn't he, with his shower cap, with his back to him, but why does he have to sing loudly to draw attention to himself?
Exactly, and they keep looking over at him.
Checking him out.
Yeah, they keep looking at him. What are they doing, just looking at his arse or what? But they probably think, you know, why is he making that horrible noise?
I think that's what we're supposed to think. But the other thing is, it's only a small cottage hospital, presumably, isn't it? Why doesn't Henderson not know who this bloke is? It must be one of the doctors, because they're the only people allowed in there.
Yeah, he does look a bit quizzical, doesn't he? But, yeah. But anyway, they leave the room, and sort of turns the shower off and grabs a towel, wraps it around himself. We notice at this point he's got a tattoo on his arm, which is interesting.
Yeah, it seems to be some sort of a serpent, isn't it? Apparently it was done on a birthday bender during Pertwee's Navy days.
Is that what they used to call him, a birthday bender?
They did, yeah. He used to give everyone a birthday treat once a year. But no, apparently he was in his cups one night and ended up having his tattoo done. Interesting to see when the doctor leaves that room. His hair dries instantly, doesn't it? Although I suppose he did have a shower cap on, but it does seem quite wet on the way out, and by the time he's into the change room, it's absolutely dry.
Anyway, he starts looking around for some clothes, doesn't he? Meanwhile, unit soldiers are out in the woods, and they're digging up this energy unit, which is still in the ground. As they remove it, you hear the pulsing noise again, and you see an Orton in the woods, which immediately turns and starts heading off, presumably in the direction of this energy unit.
Meanwhile, back at the hospital, this bigwig is called Dr. Beavis, isn't he? He was wearing a black cape and a big hat when he came in. The doctor finds these and puts them on along with some other clothes. He escapes from the hospital in Beavis's vintage car. He tries to get into an MGBGT but can't get in. And eventually works out how this vintage car works and drives off. So at this point, we've pretty much got the signature Pertwee look, haven't we? Because we've got the ruffled shirt and the cape and, you know, that sort of necktie that he wears, and a vintage car. Although it isn't Bessie, because Bessie appears first in the next story, the Silurians, but he's pretty much all there, isn't he, at this stage in episode 2.
Yeah. It cuts to the Brigadier and Liz. So they're talking about the fact the Doctor's got away, and the Brigadier tries the TARDIS key in the door, but it won't open for him. The soldiers, meanwhile, bring this energy unit to a unit Land Rover, and Munro is there with them, and he tells them to take it straight to the headquarters. But as it drives off, it's going along a country road, and Orton steps out in front of it, causing it to swerve and hit a tree, and then you get this nasty shot of the smashed windscreen covered in blood and the head of the unit soldier, which you can't quite see, but it's a bit grim, really, isn't it?
It is grim, and you'd see a nice reflection of the Orton kind of looking into the window to see that he's dead, and then the Orton takes the... it's an ammo box, isn't it? The sphere, and he goes to the back of the truck and takes it. But it's interesting the way they shoot this, isn't it? Because you get a kind of sort of windscreen view of the Orton stepping out of the road, which is really creepy, isn't it? And then you get a slightly unconvincing crash, don't you? You don't actually see anything crash. You just, it's all done via sound effects and subjective camera work, isn't it? The colour of the blood on the windscreen is a little bit too vibrant as well, but it's a nice scene, though.
Yeah. Next, we see the control room at the plastics factory where Channing's inside. We see this room quite a lot from now on, don't we? You've got a bank of Ortons along one wall, about, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them, I guess, all standing still against the wall. In the middle of the room, there's this kind of raised tank. At one end, there's a glass screen with this strange thing inside. It looks a bit like an eye. And then you've got other equipment in the room. You've got a big control panel along one side. Obviously, this is where everything's being controlled by Channing.
it seems to be Ransom's old workshop, doesn't it?
He lets Hibbert into the room, who comes in, and he tells him that Scobie is on his way. It's a bit intriguing at this point. He's like, well, why, what's Scobie got to do with it? The doctor, meanwhile, has made his way to the unit headquarters, and he arrives into the underground car park in this vintage car that is nicked. When he gets to the car park attendant, again, Derek Sherwin, he shows the first signs of the rudeness that dominates his character later in the run.
Mm.
He kind of says, oh, I suppose you want to see my pass. Well, just tell the Brigadier I want to see him. Don't just stand there arguing, man. Get on with it.
Yeah, it's a great line. Don't stand there arguing with me, man. He hasn't actually got a word in it. But, yeah, so that's going to be, as you say, he's quite a genial figure throughout this, except for this moment, isn't he? Throughout the story.
Yeah, I think it's quite different in this story that a lot of the time with first stories, characterisation will be slightly different.
Yeah.
As to what it becomes later. But yeah, I mean, this is kind of the first signs of a trait which I don't particularly like about him, to be honest. But sometimes it works, sometimes you just think, well, don't be such an arse.
No, I mean, it's supposed to be a kind of anti-establishment thing, but I mean, he tends to shout at the little man, doesn't he, rather than anyone else. I mean, the commissioner there is not his fault that he needs to see the passes. Seems to be shooting the messenger a lot of the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, the doctor gets into the lab and meets up with the Brigadier, who's a bit amazed that he managed to find them, but the doctor shows him this kind of watch-like device on his wrist, which homes in on the TARDIS. He also reveals that the TARDIS key will work if he uses it, but the Brigadier says he's got too many questions to ask him to let him get into the TARDIS and maybe disappear. But the doctor says, no point in asking a load of questions because he's lost his memory. But clearly only selectively.
He then starts talking about his new face, doesn't he? Asking what he thinks of his new face. He says it's very flexible and useful on the planet Delphon, where they communicate with their eyebrows. And then the Brigadier introduces Liz, who's kind of been standing nearby, and the Doctor sort of wiggles his eyebrows there. He says that's Delphon for how do you do? Which is all a bit crap, really.
That's quite humorous, isn't it? He also reveals he's a doctor of practically everything.
Yeah.
But that answer as to what sort of doctors changes every time anyone asks a question.
They tell him about these meteorites, and he starts to have a look at this fragment of that they brought back to the lab, and he begins to start to kind of help them. Which the Brigadier sort of says, are you agreeing to help us then? And he says, well, if I help you, will you give me the TARDIS key back? So they reach this kind of understanding that the Brigadier will give him a key back if he helps him.
Well, the Brigadier says possibly, doesn't he? So,
yeah, playing his cards close to his chest.
Mm. Yeah, the Doctor's been looking at the broken bits of the sphere, and he deduces that there was something inside. And he also believes that the sphere's been collected and taken somewhere. The question is where. The next scene we see is where they've been taken, which is a plastics factory where we see Ransom climbing over a high wall and getting into the grounds.
Yeah, inside, it's in Hibbert's office, I think. General Scobie is there. And he's obviously having a mannequin made of himself. And he's being shown it by Channing and Hibbert. And their meeting's just finishing. So Channing starts to show Scobie out of the building. Ransom, meanwhile, has used a crowbar to break in. And he's making his way up to his old office. And he manages to force the door open. And he goes inside, and this is where we find, as you said earlier, it's the room with the Autons in it.
Yeah, we previously saw this row of boiler-suited Autons all lined up at one side of the room. And as Ransom is investigating all these new equipment that's now in his old workshop, he hears a noise from behind him, and he does a kind of very sort of slow turnaround, doesn't he? He's clearly already spooked. And he kind of slowly looks around, and this Auton has stepped off this platform where all the others are lined up, and is walking towards him. And then you see Ransom see this terrible plastic face, and he pulls this brilliant face, doesn't he, of pure terror.
Yeah.
And you just see the Auton raise its hand towards him, and the episode ends.
This is where they've reshot the start of the next episode, because at the end of episode 2, the Auton walks towards it, raises its arm and walks towards it, but its arm outstretched. But at the start of episode 3, it raises its arm and the hand hinges back to reveal the gun.
Mm.
It would have been far more effective to have had the gun at the end of episode 2, wouldn't it?
With the cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
Because the gun doesn't appear, does it?
Yeah, we've never seen an Auton use its hand weapon yet, have we? So that would have been a nice reveal at that point, wouldn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, it's a good scene from then on, isn't it, where it shoots at Ransom and misses. And Ransom legs it out of the workshop. And we're used to seeing Doctor Who monsters sort of stomping about slowly towards people, aren't we? What's quite frightening about the Autons is they actually got a bit of speed to them, haven't they?
Well, yeah, they can run very fast when they want to, can't they?
Yeah, and when you see this Auton pursuing Ransom at quite some speed through the doors of his factory.
Mm.
Although at one point when the Ransom gets out into the exterior fire escape steps and gets most of the way down before the Auton appears, which the Auton seems to have been slowed up for some reason, doesn't it?
Mm.
Just as Channing, Hibbert and Scobie are walking along this kind of alleyway down the side of the factory, and the Auton obviously still after Ransom, but Channing sees the Auton and seems to kind of telepathically signal to it to stop and go back in the building, which it does to sort of kind of mournful cello.
It gives Ransom the opportunity to get away. But yeah, Channing kind of looks at it almost annoyed at it, doesn't he?
Mm.
As if, what are you doing out of your box?
Yeah, and the reaction and that sort of that mournful cello sound.
Yeah.
The Auton looks kind of sort of sheepish, doesn't it?
Yeah, it looks like, oh.
Lowers its head and sort of walks backwards into the building.
Yeah. As if it's done something wrong, sort of thing. But anyway, Channing and Hibbert say goodbye to Scobie, and he says that he wants to see his mannequin before he goes to Madame Tussauds.
He wouldn't want to see it. I mean, he knows what's coming next to
him. No, not really.
Channing says that will be arranged, and of course it is arranged that he will see the backs of them.
Mm.
It's interesting that Channing doesn't shake Scobie's hand, does he?
No.
Really, because it would be slightly plasticky to the touch, I mean.
I would imagine so. Channing and Hibbert are in the control room, and they're talking about the fact that Ransom was there and the Auton saw him. Hibbert asks him how he knows it was Ransom. And they've got his brain print. Obviously, they can recognise brain prints of humans. And he tells Hibbert that he's going to send an Auton to kill him. Hibbert seems a bit upset about this. He says, well, it's necessary. Think about it, and you'll see that it is necessary.
Yeah, he sort of gets him back into a hypnotic state, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because Hibbert and Ransom used to be friends, didn't they? So there's some part of Hibbert's humanity is poking through there, isn't it, when he finds out that Ransom's going to be killed.
Mm.
But Channing resumes control. And, meanwhile, we see Ransom running through the woods and out into a clearing where there's members of UNIT, and he sort of shouts something unintelligible to him and then collapses onto the floor.
Mm.
There's a classic scene, isn't there, with Meg and Sam Seeley, where she's telling him about the UNIT jeep crashing and the driver being killed in the crash. But the fact that I think it's a local policeman said that he had this terrible look on his face. And she says, something must have frightened him terrible before he died.
Yeah. Ransom is in shock. The UNIT soldiers have set up a kind of a tent in the somewhere near the woods, I guess. And he's inside, and they give him a tea or a coffee to drink, which he kind of dribbles down his chin as he's trying to tell them that what he'd seen, but he's in too much shock at the moment to get anything out.
Yeah, what do you think of the acting on the scene?
It's a little over the top, but I don't know. I think it's all right.
Yeah, I think it's just the right side of over the top. Mm. But
after this, they obviously managed to calm him down, so it's okay. Back at the lab, the doctor and Liz, the doctor's complaining about the primitive equipment they've got to try and do some tests on this meteorite fragment. And then he cunningly manages to convince Liz that he's got some equipment in the TARDIS, and that if she goes and gets the key off the Brigadier, he'll be able to go and, you know, get in there and get it. And of course she has no idea, well, she doesn't believe the fact that this is a time and space machine, so she kind of agrees that she'll see what she can do.
He mentions the TARDIS is dimensionally transcendental, doesn't he, at this point, which I think is the first time that phrase is used as well, isn't it?
I think it is. Meanwhile, back in the woods, Sam Seeley is being shown in to see Munro, and he's obviously after a reward for finding one of these meteorites. Again, Munro questions him about it, and he's pretending that he doesn't really know where one is, but Munro's not having any of that. I really like Munro's character.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think he's quite superior to the Mike Yates character. I would sooner have seen Munro as the Brigadier's second in command throughout, really. You do get a couple of others, don't you? Captain Hawkins, is it? Paul Darrow in Silurians, and I think there's a couple of others before we get, the real team of regulars with Benton and Yates and Joe Grant in Terrorville since the beginning of the next season. But yeah, I'm with you. I think Munro's an excellent character, and yeah, I think he should have been kept on.
But it's well documented and about the fact that the use of unit, especially the Brigadier, gets more and more pantomime as we go through the Doctor's era. He's a very strong character in this story, and in latter stories he just becomes a bumbling idiot, really, doesn't he?
Brigadier, yeah, it does.
And unit become very ineffectual, whereas they're actually pretty good in this, aren't they?
The Keystone Soldiers, aren't they?
Yeah. Channing and Hibbert, I like it actually, but these scenes with Channing and Hibbert where they're by that control panel and they're kind of looking at, there's a circular screen, isn't there, but there's never anything on it that you can really see. And they're looking at it and their faces are very close together, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a slight wide angle lens or anything like that, but they're very close into the screen and it's very good.
Yeah, they're kind of whispering to each other and Channing's always got these, like I said earlier, his eyes are just amazing.
Yeah, it's a terrific performance, and it's good even that close. You sometimes see Hibbert turning to look at him, don't you?
Mm.
When he says something particularly weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very good scenes, and it's almost kind of some sort of shot from the point of view of the screen they're looking at.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, they're talking about the fact that Ransom's now gone out of the Auton range, and they speculate they may have gone to Unit. Channing says that they're nearing the final phase of their plan. But the swarm leader is still missing. And he also says that if Ransom returns to the area, the Autons will kill him.
Ransom's calmed down a bit in the Brigadier's office. Liz, at this point, comes in to try and get the key from the Brigadier, but he kind of shooes her away in slightly patronising fashion.
She gets
annoyed, but then sees the key on his desk, so she kind of secretly pockets it and disappears, but meanwhile the Brigadier carries on his conversation with Ransom, and only at the end of the scene does he notice that the key is missing.
Mm. Well, the Doctor's taken the key from Liz, and he goes inside the TARDIS as the Brigadier sort of runs into the room. Liz kind of leans against the TARDIS and kind of ignores him when he starts questioning her, doesn't he? And she's got kind of a smile on her face, and quite pleased with herself. And he says, oh, that's the last we'll see of him. And the TARDIS... Yeah, we hear the TARDIS try to dematerialise, but the engines sound very off-kilter. And there's all this sort of crashing noises, and smoke starts to appear out of just appears from the TARDIS, doesn't it? And then the door opens, more smoke comes out, and the Doctor follows it with a little cough. This is just testing. Liz is annoyed that he's tricked her, but he says, sorry, but the temptation was too strong. He sort of refers to being stuck in one place and one time, isn't it?
Yeah, he does a nice sort of sheepish schoolboy routine, doesn't he? Which, he does occasionally, doesn't he, during his incarnation. He does it a couple of times, as one at the end of Claws of Axos. But a couple of points about the TARDIS here. One is, this is the first close-up we get of it, and it looks absolutely knackered, doesn't it? Really battered and beaten up.
Yeah.
Which, I guess they got away with more easily in the days of black and white, but in colour and on film, it looks really awful. the other point is, when the Doctor uses the key and gets in, he says the lock has a metabolism detector. This is extremely inconsistent, isn't it, throughout the history of the show, who can use a TARDIS key and get in and who can't.
Normally it's just other companions that can use it, isn't it? I think the Master uses it time to time, but he probably knows how to sort of bypass it, I suppose.
But
what else do we find out? He doesn't refer to the Time Lords, does he? But he says that they, they changed the dematerialisation code so that's why he can't, you know, it's not working for him. The Brigadier asks for the key, but the Doctor says, well, there's no point, it no longer works anyway. Back at the Seeley household, Mrs. Seeley goes out to the shed and she pulls out the metal box that Sam's hidden this thing in. So she's obviously not convinced that he was telling her the truth. Ransom is talking to the Brigadier and the Doctor and Liz and telling them a bit more about what he's found, you know, what he saw. And the Doctor suggests they better go and visit the plastics factory and have a word with them on what's going on.
Yeah, then we have a scene back in the unit tent where Munro is still trying to get some sort of information out of Seeley, who's utterly infuriated in this scene. Basically saying, you know, trying to get, ask whether he can get some money for the sphere without revealing that he's actually got the sphere. And Munro's really losing his patience with him.
And Meg basically finally opens the box to reveal the energy unit, which he's a bit aghast about. Immediately, Channing and Hibbert pick up the signal, as does the Auton, which is in the woods. You can tell here that Channing can obviously see what the Auton is doing as it's doing it, although it's not apparent on that screen, as we said, because Hibbert can't see what's going on, can he?
Yeah, Hibbert keeps looking at the screen to try and get some clues, doesn't he? But yeah. It's all in Channing's mind, isn't it? Channing's clearly seeing through the eyes of the Auton, isn't he?
Exactly.
Even though you don't see through the Auton's eyes as a viewer, it's still very effective, isn't it?
Yeah. And he directs it to the house, doesn't he? Munro and Seeley, finally Munro's managed to get out of him where the meteorite is, at which point the Brigadier, the Doctor and Liz turn up, and they decide they're all going to go up to the house, but they leave Ransom behind in the tent. Meg has closed the trunk and is putting it back into the shed, but it's too late because she hears the dog barking, and then it kind of whines and goes quiet, doesn't it?
Yeah, what do you think about this dog barking? I don't think it's a dog. I think it's a human pretending to be a dog.
Really?
Yeah.
Surely they would have had they wouldn't have even had to have a dog there, would they? There must be sound recordings of the dog barking.
Yeah, they obviously are, but I don't think they used one. I might be wrong. Anyway, the upshot is that she hears noises coming from inside the house. Presumably something nasty's happened to this dog as it stops barking and has a little whine, doesn't it? Mm. She enters her cottage, and there's a brilliant scene, isn't there, where she sees a figure through a doorway, and it swings around, and it's one of the killer Autons. She runs out into the yard, and very slowly fills both barrels of a shotgun as the Auton approaches, and fires both barrels into his chest, and is horrified to see that it has absolutely no effect.
Yeah, I mean, you see the shots hit it, don't you, but it just carries on as if nothing's happened. Channing is kind of ordering the Auton to look for, what's the swarm leader, isn't it? But the signal's muffled, and he's getting quite agitated. You know, we must find it. Meg is kind of lying on the floor outside in the yard. The Auton's gone back into the house and is sort of knocking everything off the walls and off the tables, everything, smashing everything up, trying to find it. And then it comes back out into the backyard, walks towards the shed, and it looks as if it's going to walk past it, but then it suddenly swings round and barges in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite funny.
Yeah, at this point, Unit arrive at the cottage, and they go into the room and see everything smashed up, and then they hear activity outside the house at the other end. So they go out to the yard, and they find the Auton, and the soldiers and the Brigadier shoot at it, but again, to no effect. You then cut back to Channing and Hibbert at the factory, and Channing basically says, "Recall! Recall!" and recalls the Auton, and it turns on its heel and runs off.
Yeah, but Channing does notice that Ransom has returned to the area, so decides that they'll deal with him. Dr. and Liz are examining the energy unit. Meg apparently is okay, but she's going to need to go to hospital. And then we get a shot of an Auton slicing through the back of the tent. It basically uses its gun hand, doesn't it, to sticks it through the tent, slides it down like a kind of a zip, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And goes inside where Ransom is sitting terrified on this kind of bench. And Channing calls for the Auton to destroy. and it shoots him. And then Channing says, total destruction. And it shoots him again. And you get this kind of reverse smoke effect, don't you?
Mm.
And the body basically disappears entirely, leaving no trace. And the autumn basically leads back through the split in the tent.
Yeah, and then you see the brigadier being furious with the sergeant, doesn't he, that he let Ransom escape. Of course, they don't know that Ransom's been obliterated, and just think he's gone somewhere. And the doctor guesses that he might be at the plastics factory. And this is one of those cuts you're talking about, isn't it? Because instantly we're at the factory with the brigadier and the doctor and Liz.
They're shown in by the secretary, aren't they, again? As they're waiting outside Hibbert's office, the brigadier has this feeling that he's being watched, and he turns round, and you get this wonderful shot of Shanning's face through a kind of a frosted glass window, don't you? Literally inches from the brigadier's face, just looking at it. It's really good.
Yeah, it's very creepy, isn't it? And it's kind of obscured with those kind of vertical slats or whatever, aren't they? And as he retreats, his face gets very distorted, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's a really, really good shot.
Yeah. Anyway, they go in to see Hibbert, who he basically laughs off Ransom's story, doesn't he?
Which is quite odd, because he's not a very sort of laughy sort of bloke, is he? But
it's obviously some sort of pep talk from Channing before they arrived, because he's...
Well, Channing did one of his legendary stand-up routines.
Yeah, and he basically says that it's all untrue. Ransom was obviously upset that he'd been sacked, and it's just a case of sour grapes, basically, isn't it? They ask what's being made there, and he says that they make mannequins for shop windows. And then he laughs off the doctor's suggestion that they can move around on their own. Yeah, and he, as I said, he says that Ransom was basically just making trouble. So the doctor says, oh, well, we might as well leave then. So off they go. But back at the headquarters, when they're in the lab, the brigadier's saying that he recognised Channing from the photo, so that, you know, they're going to move on the factory. All he needs is Scobie's authorisation. Yeah, the doctor's got this readout from a machine that he's using to testing the mental activity of this energy unit, and it's showing that there's obviously something alive inside it. Meanwhile, the brigadier's talking with Scobie on the phone. Scobie sort of says, oh yeah, he's been to the factory recently and they seemed okay. But obviously the brigadier sort of tells him something else. He says, oh well, you know, definitely I'll give you my full support, and hangs up. And there's a knock on the door. And he goes to the door, opens it, and lo and behold, he is faced by himself.
Yes.
A replica of himself, which walks into the house menacingly and walks towards him, and he sort of goes, no, no. And the music comes up, and it's the end of the episode. Yeah, quite a good ending, I think.
Yeah, it's a split-screen effect, isn't it? Yeah, there's a kind of a Vaseline version of him, isn't there? And one half the screen and the normal version, the left-hand side of the screen.
Back in the lab, they're experimenting on the energy unit, but the apparatus basically plays a fuse. They think it might be a collective intelligence, don't they? And it needs a shell to contain itself.
Yeah, the doctor says that the various parts are signalling to each other, aren't they? So the energy units are signalling to the main part of it. Yeah, and the doctor says they need to fashion a sort of physical body for the entity, don't they? Otherwise there'd be no point in coming, is what he says, isn't it? There we go. Anyway, General Scobie's replica is immediately called into to action, isn't he? He calls the brigadier and tells him that the factory's off limits. There's some important work going on at the moment, which the brigadier is not allowed to interrupt. And before the brigadier can give any sort of argument, Scobie hangs up. And so the brigadier says, well, he'll have to go over his head and go to the Home Secretary, and if that fails, then go to the unit head office in Geneva. But importantly, he says, you know, the stupid old fool, Scobie's all puffed up because he's having this model made for Madame Tussauds, isn't it?
Mm.
And this immediately pricks up the doctor's interest, isn't it?
So, cut immediately to the doctor and Liz at Madame Tussauds, where they're wandering through looking at some of the waxworks, and they all appear to be top civil servants. Liz makes the, you know, points this out, that, you know, where are all the pop stars and astronauts and whatever, and they find that a little bit strange. The sort of the curator of the museum, I guess, he points them towards Scobie, who it's clearly whereas the others there are probably real waxwork, Scobie clearly isn't, because he's doing his best to stand still, but he doesn't quite look still enough, does he?
Well, I think he's not bad, actually. And I
he's
think
not bad.
some of the others are human.
Yeah.
Aren't they? Because there's another one that's swaying a little bit.
Mm.
And as we see later, they come to life. So, but yeah, this is the curator saying that he's the latest one in, isn't he? And he's the latest in a new line, all made of plastic. So,
yeah.
You know, obviously they're all made by our friends at Autoplastics.
Yeah. Anyway, the doctor's having a look at Scobie. He's sort of taking a very close look at him. And this is getting a bit annoyed. Points out that, you know, why would you put a working wristwatch on a waxwork that is actually wound up to the correct time, you know. So it's obviously the real Scobie. They decide to wait for closing time when they can have a good look around, basically.
Back at the factory in Ransom's old workshop, Channing shows Hibbert this tank, the tank that we saw before. He says that the energy units, the spheres, have created inside the perfect life form. Mm. But he also says they need this form leader sphere in order for this process to be completed. And he tells you that they can use this Scobie replica to get it from unit. He also adds that that night the autons will be activated.
Mm. We cut to the unit lab where Scobie has arrived and is basically trying to take the energy unit away. Munro sort of tries to stop him from taking it, but basically Scobie threatens him with arrest if he doesn't let him take it. So Munro basically has no option but to let him go. Mm. Back at Madame Tussauds, the curator is sort of turning out the lights and locking up and leaving. And the Doctor and Liz come out from behind the curtain where they've been hiding. And they start to have a good look at the waxworks. A
couple of funny moments here, aren't there?
Yeah.
The Doctor says, funny how their eyes seem to follow you around the room. And Liz says, hilarious. And at one point, the Doctor's very still looking at something. And Liz must think he's a waxwork, wasn't she? Because when he moves, she suddenly gets really spooked.
Just a question about this bit. Why is Scobie and Madame Tussauds? What have they put in there? It doesn't seem to make any sense. You know, why don't they just kill Scobie?
Well, I don't think they can kill him, can they? I think maybe he needs to be alive for them to use the print. The reason that he's at Madame Tussauds is very unclear, because surely it'd be better just hidden away somewhere, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He's the only human there, isn't he? All the others are the Auton replicas, mm. All those other civil servants. So it does seem odd that he would be there. Maybe they think he's out of the way enough there.
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't quite add up as to why he would be there, but... Channing and the Hibberts arrive at Madame Tussauds, don't they? Dr. and Liz hear them coming and they go and hide. And they come in. Channing senses an alien life form. But Hibbert says, well, it must be Scobie. So, you know, he assumes it's him. Hibbert asks him, what do we need to do to activate them? And he says, well, we don't have to do anything. They know it's time. And they suddenly all spring to life, don't they? And start to leave the building. Channing says they're going to take their places, presumably in sort of key government positions. Mm. Interestingly, though, that hasn't really followed up on, is it?
It is in the book, but not really so much on screen. For some reason, Hibbert pops back into the room where all the Autons have just left and where the Doctor and Liz are. They have a brief conversation, and the Doctor says that the Autons have killed Ransom. And Hibbert's clearly still sort of at least semi-hypnotized by Channing at this point, and he's saying that they had to kill Ransom. You know, Channing said that it was necessary. But the Doctor tries to break the hypnosis, telling him that Channing's controlling his mind and that Channing's Hibbert's enemy and the enemy of the entire human race. Mm. And he tells him he's got to escape from Channing, and if he comes to the unit, they'll help him.
Mm. Yeah, Channing pops back in, you know, asking him what he's doing. He says he was just checking, and they leave. And interestingly, he doesn't give them away, does he? So he's obviously taken in what the Doctor's been saying. Another slight niggle with this is, why did they need to go there at all? Channing says that the Autons would have known when to to activate themselves. So what was the point of them actually going there?
Well, I think to open the door.
Is that it? Just to let them out?
Well, maybe you can only open it from the outside rather than the inside, I don't know. But,
immediately, Dr. and Liz are back at headquarters, and they're telling the Brigadier that he has to move against the factory now. You know, it's obviously already starting to kick off, so it's imperative they move immediately. Channing and Scobie are talking. They're in the control room. And Channing places the swarm leader into one of the machines. And as soon as he does that, the eye in the tank starts to pulse, doesn't it? It kind of pulses backwards and forwards.
Yeah, it's quite revolting, isn't it?
It is quite revolting, yeah. It's sort of green goo around it, isn't it? And
yeah, it's got these sort of tendons around the side of it, isn't it? It kind of keeps pressing against the outside of the tank. Mm. Really quite unpleasant. but also during this scene, they agree that Hibbert is no longer necessary. He's getting harder to control, but they don't need him anymore, so you know, his seconds are numbered from here on in.
Yeah, so they say they plan to activate the Autons at dawn, and then we cut to the unit lab, and it's 5:30 in the morning. And the Doctor and Liz have obviously been up all night, and Liz is quite tired, and the Doctor's been working on one of his famous lash-ups. he's putting together some sort of device that he hopes will interfere with...
It's to try and stop the nesting consciousness communicating with its various parts, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's sort of jam signal.
And then we get the famous Ealing Broadway scene, don't we?
Absolutely iconic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's obviously it's early morning, the streets are deserted, the camera kind of pans across this shop window, and inside there's these dummies that suddenly start to come to life.
All wearing fantastic 70s clothing.
Yeah, exactly. And their hands split open to reveal the Auton guns. You hear the smashing of a shop window, and a policeman starts running towards where he's heard this noise come from.
He must be the most flattest footed... most flat-footed Bobby in history, isn't
he? He is pretty flat-footed. But anyway, he runs towards these shop window dummies have come out, and he sort of runs into them, and they shoot at a woman, screams. More Autons come to life. There's a man on a bicycle going past, and he's shot, and he falls off his bike. There's a load of people at a bus stop who are simply oblivious to what's been going on, but are basically shot at. Some of them fall to the ground, others run off. And there's a great bit where a man is kind of running along and he's shot as he's running, and he does a nice sort of running tumble, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, it's all good. There's some slightly odd cuts, I thought, in this scene, but it does work very well.
Yeah, it's great. You know, as you say, the most kind of iconic memory of the Autons from the 70s, I think. And of course, they reused it in Rose, the new series.
They did, yeah.
The Brigadier's on the phone. And he's obviously been told about what's happening, and apparently it's happening all over the world.
Yeah, this is the point where it's he says that Autons or shop window dummies are coming to life and attacking police stations, barracks and communications centres, and Liz discovers that the radio is also dead.
Mm.
In the book it goes into much greater detail about how the replicas are in these key positions, and they're putting a stop on any sort of retaliatory action, really.
Mm.
So they're just causing a kind of a storm of red tape.
Yeah.
And they a line about that, I think, would have been useful in the actual programme.
Anyway, the Doctor seems to have finished the device that he's been working on, and he sort of says to the Brig, you know, we've got to get down there. But, you know, the Brig is all the only staff he's got are his security staff, so there's only a handful of soldiers that he can take with him. They head off for the factory. Hibbert, meanwhile, is in the control room. You hear the Doctor's voice urging him to resist Channing, and he's got like a big metal pole with him, isn't he? And he starts to hit the controls on the side of this tank, and he knocks one of them off, and this sort of green goo starts spurting out.
Yeah, that's a really nice touch.
There's turmoil going on in his head, because he keeps kind of stopping and summoning out the courage to carry on, doesn't he? And anyway, Channing bursts in and tells him to stop, and tries to get hold of his control over him again, but Hibbert's not having any of it.
Yeah, Hibbert keeps trying to turn his back and not look at him, doesn't he, to try and keep hold of his senses. At this point, Channing tells him that he is part of the Nestines.
Nestines?
Yes. Who have been colonising other planets for 1,000 million years, and now they've come to colonise Earth. He does the usual, Hibbert says, you'll kill us all then, won't you? And Channing does the usual, no, you'll be spared because you've helped us.
Yeah.
You know, as they used to say in the playground in my era, shinny wreck on. that is not going to happen, is it? It will be mashed along with everyone else.
And he starts to hit the tank again, but an Auton springs to life and shoots him, and Channing orders total destruction. So he's vanished out of existence.
The doctor and the soldiers leave the unit HQ and head for the factory.
They arrive at the factory and they manage to get inside. There's an alarm goes off which warns Channing that they're there. And they start to get out the fire escape, and Scobie arrives with a load of army soldiers and confronts them. The Brigadier sort of shouts to them that, you know, it's not the real Scobie. And then he great bit with the doctor says, well, let's see, shall we? And he walks towards Scobie with his device. He says, would you mind speaking into this microphone? And tells Liz to turn it on. And Scobie falls to the ground, you know, becomes inert. And they turn him over and his face has disappeared. It's just the Auton face, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So you're clearly just a replica. And at this point, we get a close-up shot of Scobie in the waxworks sort of jerking to life, and you can just hear the gasps from the sort of customers around the side.
The Brigadier sort of commandeers the rest of the soldiers to help him, and the Doctor and Liz start sneaking into the factory, at which point some of the Autons are coming out to find them. They kind of hide from one as it goes past, and they manage to mobilise it with the Doctor's device. And then a big kind of battle ensues between the Autons and the unit soldiers, which the Autons are winning hands down, really, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a very, very similar scene to the one in The Invasion, isn't it, where the unit take on these Cybermen. And it's actually in exactly the same location.
It is, isn't it, yeah.
Yeah, it's the TCC Condensers Factory, otherwise known as the Guinness Factory, because at one point Guinness was made there.
So the Doctor and Liz manage to get to the control room. Liz sort of crouches outside by the door, doesn't she, with the machine, and the Doctor goes in. It's got this kind of what you called, referred to as the microphone earlier, but it's on the long lead that's attached to this machine.
Yeah, it's sort of a probe, isn't it?
Yeah, like a probe type thing. And he goes in and he confronts Channing, and Channing turns to him, and the Doctor looks at the Nestine in the tank. And he says to Channing that they're going to destroy him. And he goes, nothing can destroy us. He's just dealt with Scobie, but he doesn't believe that they're going to be able to get to do anything. But Channing turns to the machine and turns to one of the dials, and everything starts to kick off, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The Doctor tells Liz to switch on the device, but it won't work. So, you know, he's frantically fiddling with the knobs on the Nestine tank to try and stop whatever Channing's done from going ahead. I don't know what happens to Channing at this point. He just kind of disappears, doesn't he?
Yeah, he sort of turns the control and runs off, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then you get this frantic thing between Liz, and Liz is trying to get the machine to work, the Doctor's fiddling with these knobs on the tank. And then you probably get the worst bit of the story, really, which is where the tentacles start coming out of the top of the tank, these enormous green rubber tentacles, which wrap around the Doctor's face and around his face and body and start to kind of choke him. But you know, the Doctor's kind of gurning and crossing his eyes, and it's rubbish. The tentacles are rubbish anyway.
I don't think the tentacles are that bad, actually. The big, thick ones are quite good, but the ones that wrap around his leg aren't so impressive.
You think the big ones look quite good?
They're all right, yeah, they're not too bad. They could have been made to look a bit wetter, I think.
Yeah.
They're all right. A bit of the famous Vaseline could have come in handy there, I think. Yeah, the main problem with it, I think, is Pertwee, actually, in this particular scene. All the eye-rolling and stuff is not terribly good. I mean, this is, I think, the only real sort of bum note in the story. Unfortunately, a lot of people kind of remember this bit, don't they?
It's unfortunate, because it is the climax to the story. I think it's been really strong up until this point. It just lets it down right at the end. It's a shame. But it's not well done, and it is quite laughable, I think. And, you know, Pertwee appears to be playing it for laughs, which is even worse.
Yeah.
But anyway, eventually, Liz manages to get the device to work. It appeared to me that all that had happened was that it had just come unplugged.
Yeah, that's right. The lady had come out, she just puts the jack plug back in, and it's all right again.
Yeah. She calls out it should be working again. The Doctor points this probe at the Nestine or into the tank. Immediately, the eye that's pulsing at the front starts pulsing even faster and then explodes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's true.
The tentacles kind of stop thrashing around, and the Doctor manages to get himself free. And the Autons everywhere all start falling to the floor, you know, totally inert, which is good for the unit soldiers, because I think they would have been decimated had it not happened. They have a look at Channing, and he's his face has disappeared. He's now got the, you know, the blank face, covered in some green goo as well. But he's lying on the floor. So everything seems to have been resolved, thankfully.
Back at Unit HQ, Liz has explained to the Brigadier that the Doctor's weapon against the Autumn is basically a powerful electroconvulsion therapy machine. And as you find out, that's jammed the signals there. The Brigadier asks if the Nestines might come back again, and the Doctor says, well, they're telepathic, so all the other parts of the consciousness will know what happened there on Earth. As it turns out, of course, they do return to rather lesser effect at the beginning of the next season, in Terror of the Autons.
The Brigadier sort of asks the Doctor if he'll help them again. The Doctor kind of starts bargaining with him, doesn't he? The Brigadier sort of offers him some money, but he says he's not interested in money. But what he does want is equipment to fix the TARDIS. He wants help from Liz. Actually, he refers to the fact that he's borrowed the clothes, so he's going to need some new clothes. And he liked the car. So the Brig says, oh, you know, we'll have to return the car, it's not yours. He says, but I'm sure we can find you something similar. And Liz says, great, when can we go and choose it?
Yeah, that's one of those childlike moments, isn't it?
Yeah, and the Brigadier says, you know, goodness, I don't even know your name. And he says, it's Smith, Dr. John Smith. And that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, it's good stuff.
The beginning of a new era, of course. It's all set up for the rest of that season, and is the template for much of his era, isn't it, John Pertwee's era?
But yeah, just a quick word on the viewing figures. It was 8.4, 8.1, 8.3, 8.1, so very, very consistent, just above the 8 million mark, which is pretty good, I think. But yeah, what do we think of it overall? What do you think of it overall?
Well, I think it's brilliant. I really think it's absolutely superb. For a number of reasons, really. I think the overall concept is one of the best in the show's history. You know, this control over plastic. I think it's one of the best invasion strategies, if you like, you know, to make these replicas and put them in key places in the hierarchy to facilitate the invasion. It's got some very, very creepy moments. It's got some absolutely iconic moments. The shop dummies on Ealing Broadway, Ransom discovering the Auton in the factory, the Auton attacking the Seeley's cottage, the Auton getting Ransom in the unit tent, and Scobie meeting himself. All these are really strong moments, I think.
Yeah.
The Doctor is brilliant. I think Pertwee is note perfect in this story.
Yes, yeah, I think he is. I think he's... It's a slightly more comedic portrayal in parts, but yeah, I think he's very good in it. I think the location shooting, not just the locations, but the filming, as opposed to the normal videotaping of it, gives it a very realistic feel, I think. And I think the quick cuts that we've mentioned, I think makes it really go along at a really good pace. Doesn't seem to be any scene wasted.
No, that's right.
Certainly no padding in it. I don't know. It doesn't appear to be any padding in it.
No, it's quite lean, isn't it? I mean, considering the fact you have to introduce a new Doctor and do all that stuff in part one, none of that feels particularly laboured at all, does it?
No. And it's a proper... I think quite often with latter first stories for Doctors, the emphasis is far too much on the Doctor and not enough on the story, and this gets it exactly right. It's a really strong story, but they, as you say, they still manage to deal with the regeneration.
Consider they kind of to reintroduce UNIT, don't they, and set that up for the coming stories, and introduce Liz as well. There's all sorts to be done, and
there
it's
is.
All done extremely efficiently and without dragging the plot at all.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, you know, there's great support from the guest cast, I think. I think Channing is absolutely superb.
He's definitely one of the best villains, if you like, isn't he?
Yeah. Really alien. I just mentioned, his eyes just make him really, really eerie and it sends a shiver down his spine, really. But Hibbert and Ransom are both good characters. I really enjoyed them. Munro, we've spoken about already, is really good. Dr. Henderson's good.
Yeah.
Seeley the poacher, I liked, all of them really, I think, don't think there's anybody in it that you could point out and think, you know, they didn't cut the mustard, really. They're all really good.
Well, Caroline John, as Liz, is maybe even at her best in this story as well, isn't she? She's sort of sharp, she's funny, and she's a real assistant, isn't she, in the proper sense of the word, rather than, you know, people often call companions assistants, but perhaps Liz is the only one that technically was an assistant.
Yeah, although I have to say, though, that I mean, I really like her in this. There's some great banter between her and the Brigadier, especially, which you mentioned earlier. But the one thing I would say is that despite all of her supposed expertise, as soon as a doctor arrives, all she does is hand him things. You know.
True, yeah. I mean, yeah, you get the impression she might be more used than Joe Grant in helping him. Handing things to her. She probably hands the right things to her. But yeah, you're right. She definitely takes a back seat in terms of the investigation, but then I guess that's inevitable. But a good performance from Caroline John. The whole feel of it, partly to do with, you know, the all being on film, is great. It's a very nice kind of sunny feel to the whole thing as well, isn't there? You get that feeling that there is this heat wave they're talking about.
Yeah. But yeah, the Brigadier is really good. He's much, you know, he's a very authoritative figure. He's quite ruthless with the Doctor. You know, once he's made a decision, that's it for him. You know, there's no dithering that you get with him later, like you do even later. I think he's really good in this, probably one of his strongest stories.
It's helped by the fact that he isn't undermined too much in this story, isn't he? Eventually the Doctor and, to an extent, Joe start running rings around him, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. Negatives? I've only got one or two negative points. You know, that strange model shot of the TARDIS at the start was a bit odd. Didn't like that. Yeah, the tentacles and the gurning at the end is about the only main problem with it, I think. There isn't much else that's wrong with it. I think it's really strong.
There's a little bit of doubt, I suppose, as we discussed why Scobie's at the Waxworks, but...
Yeah, there's a couple of minor plot issues, but very minor. You could, you know, there are answers. You can think of an answer to them.
Well, with the Scobie thing, they might have had to do that in case Scobie called up Madame Tussauds and asked about his character, so they may have had to tell him there was one coming.
Yeah.
In case they gave news. But, you know, it's not important, is it? Anyway.
No.
But, so to me, you know, it's almost faultless.
Yeah. Pretty good stuff.
Should we do a bit of feedback?
Do a bit of feedback, yeah. Yeah, we got some feedback from Mike Wemban about the story, which is posted on our Facebook page. He says that it's got to be one of his favourite stories. I first got introduced to this by reading the Target novelisation, written at a time when Terence Dix wasn't sleepwalking through his books. And it gave some extra detail, as I remember. He says he refers to to it being shot on film and location, and that it sets it apart from the rest of the series, makes it seem a more lavish production, more like The Avengers or The Prisoner. Any show that has got a copper gunned down by an alien force wearing flares and kipper ties has got to be worth a watch. He says there's bits in there that don't make too much sense, like all the stuff with the autumn replicas in Madame Tussauds. Why would they be waiting there? Why not just replace the humans straight away like they did with Scobie? Also, who made Channing?
Good point.
Yeah. He says that as we've said, why did they kidnap the Doctor? Doesn't really convince. But he does think that the story is full of great set pieces which hold it together. Unlike its sequel, which doesn't make any sense at all. Probably agree with that. And he finally says, good characters. The Doctor is quite a nice guy still. The Brigadier is not an idiot. There's a person under alien control. Why did the Doctor try to break the brainwashing? It couldn't have helped him and only resulted in the poor guy getting destruction, total destruction. Yeah, but he wasn't willing to know that, was he?
No.
Also, a poacher. Don't see so many of them these days, but in the 70s you couldn't move for them. Also, a great score by Dudley Simpson.
Yeah, that's good. It's a nice score. As I was saying, there's that really nice bit when Liz drives up towards the unit HQ, and there's some lovely bits throughout. That cello bit we talked about, didn't we? Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, so thanks for that, Mike. my brother Rob has also come up with some feedback on Spirit from Space, which I know is one of his favourites. He says Patrick Troughton had broken new ground with the first regeneration of the Time Lord and shown that it could work. With John Pertwee's turn, a few more changes were included, such as the change of assistant in Exile to Earth, and from a production point of view, a change from black and white to colour. Also, the industrial action at the BBC preventing the use of any studio time further increased the potential for production difficulties. But the resulting use of location filming throughout the story also adds to the already different feel of previous stories. As the story starts after the unseen second regeneration of the Time Lord, it must have left the audience at the time almost as uncertain as the Brigadier as to the true identity of the new Doctor. The story hangs together well, and most parts are acted well. The expressionless Autons were truly frightening, and as a child of five when this was first shown, made me nervous of shock dummies for quite a while afterwards. It's interesting to note that the Autons were chosen to launch the all-new Doctor Who in the 21st century. So thanks for that, Rob.
Yeah. Hope
to hear from you again soon.
Good stuff. Well, it's time to rate it then, I guess.
Yes, it is, indeed. Do you want to go first?
Okay. I would give this 9 out of 10, for all the reasons we've already given. It loses a point for the ending. But, yeah, it's got to be one of the best Who's around, I think. So, yeah, almost full marks, but not quite.
Okay, I am going to go one more than that, I think. I know there is that scene at the end, but other than Pertwee's face, I don't know that they could have done that much better, really, given, you know, the facility of the time or anything like that. And even despite that, the whole thing's just so superb that I'm just going to have to give it a 10. For me, it's top five Doctor Who stories, so that's a 10 for me.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Well, pretty good then.
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
Better than average.
Better than average. Above average, definitely.
Yes.
Okay. Well, shall we talk about what we're going to do next time?
Yes, your choice, is it?
I think it's my choice. We're going to go back to the swinging 60s.
Woohoo!
With a William Hartnell story, and we're going to go for the War Machines.
Ah, I thought you might say that when you said swinging 60s, because it's the Inferno Disco, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. With the Doctor doing his, strutting his stuff.
Yes, that's always worth a look.
Or not. yeah, the War Machines, I thought we'd go for a Hartnell towards, you know, from his last season. As a contrast to the Web Planet, which we've already done. So, yeah, see what we think of that one.
Excellent. Okay. Good. Well, if anyone out there has any thoughts on War Machines, then get in contact with us through the usual channels, which is via email at crinoid@mail.com or the blog page at crinoid.blog.co.uk. Or our Facebook page, which is probably best to access from the top left corner of the blog page. And we are also at Crinoid on Twitter. So you can get in contact with us there as well. So we look forward to hearing your thoughts on that. And any other thoughts you might have on Spearhead from Space, of course. A couple of things to say about Spearhead from Space before we leave it. I found the actual target normalization, the Auton invasion, rather misleading when it came to the Autons. There's a number of illustrations which will pop up on the Facebook page and the blog site showing the Autons with their guns actually hinging at the wrist rather than sort of where the fingers join the palm, which is what actually happened. Mm. So all my younger years were spent thinking that the Autons shot out from the wrist rather than from the hand, and that was only really a change when I saw the VHS of Spear from Space. And I have to say that was the only disappointment of watching Spear from Space when it came out on VHS. Often when you really love the book and you can't remember anything about the original, they can be disappointing. I actually thought Spear held up pretty well. Yeah. Speaking of target novelisation, Caroline John does a reading of that book, which is well worth the listen, partly because you get kind of extra detail that we've been talking about. And she also does an array of interesting voices, including an imitation of Hibbert, which has to be heard to be believed. Because Hibbert's got this rather stumbling way of speaking, and she tries to to have a crack at that, and it's quite amusing. So, well worth tracking that one down.
Excellent, good stuff. Okay, well, that's about it then, I think.
Yes, it is. So, thanks very much for downloading or listening this time, and we look forward to your company again next time.
Talk to you all again soon. Bye.